And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Friday edition of It's Your Turn. Nice day today. Temperature very comfortable. We're in the low 70s right now. We've had kind of filtered sunshine all day so far. It's nice. It's not real hot. It's nice. Coming up later on the program today, we'll meet our first guest in a moment. Later we're going to talk about a little bit of the background of D-Day. Of course, yesterday was the big 75th anniversary of that beginning of the invasion of Fortress Europe. We're going to be chatting with a history professor from Butler County Community College. Deborah Kruger will be here in the studio to get a little bit of the historical background of D-Day. Anxious to talk with her. But that's a little bit later. First, we welcome a friend of long standing. Dawn Orwald is back in the Butler area today, and for a good reason. First of all, Dawn, good to see you again, my friend.
Good to see you, Dave.
Dawn Orwald is a retired teacher. Many of you will know him from Knock High School. He taught there for many years, directed the musicals at Knock High School for many, many years. Don's retired from teaching now, but he's still very active, and he's been a playwright for many, many years. He's written numerous plays, award-winning plays, and you've written one about the development of the Jeep.
Yes, this is a play about how the Bantam Jeep came to be, and also, of course, I think most of your listeners probably know that the Bantam Jeep originated in Butler, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Now, the reason that we're talking to Don today is because his play is being produced this weekend as part of the Bantam Jeep Heritage Festival.
That's correct, with the Jeepers all there. And as far as I know, there are going to be thousands of Jeeps and Jeepers there. And what's kind of funny is I flew from Dallas-Fort Worth to Pittsburgh to be here to do this. And I was explaining to, we were on the ground for quite a while. Luckily, we weren't in the air. I'm a little nervous about flying again. So I didn't mind being on the ground, but it gave me a chance to talk to two.
That happens so often anymore when you're ready to take off and you're stranded on the tarmac.
Exactly.
And you said it was like 3 hours at Dallas-Fort Worth Airport.
Yeah,
yesterday?
We kept thinking that they'd say, okay, we're going to get off this plane and get on another one. So many things seemed to have needed maintenance assistance that are starting to lose confidence in this play, or excuse me, in this plane. But I was trying to explain to the two guys that I was sitting with, who were people I didn't know, why I was coming to Pennsylvania and about the Jeep event. Mm-hmm. And I said, and the guys that are in the event that are Jeep owners are called Jeepers. And I'm sure these two guys are looking at me like, wow, you know, this guy must be off his medication or something. Because I was trying to explain it to him, and one guy was from Tyler, Texas, so he didn't have any idea what I was talking about. The other guy was from Pittsburgh, so he didn't know anything about Bantam or Jeeps or anything like that, but at least he knew the area. And while I was talking to them, and this is another one of the things that was wrong with the plane, the first-class lavatory was not working. So everybody had to go all the way to the back of the plane, both the people that were sitting in the front riding the leather and all of us who were in the back in the cattle car section had to use the same lav. So people came by us and had to stand in line for a while. You got 125 people trying to use one bathroom.
Not much fun to fly anymore.
Yeah, right. It's just one of those things where I'd never heard this announcement before in an airport, but they announced that we should go before we get on the plane. So that sort of turned everybody off. But anyway, while I'm sitting there and I'm trying to explain to these guys about the Jeepers, a guy comes down the aisle to use the lav wearing a T-shirt, and on the back of it says, "I'm a Jeeper."
Wow.
So then they said, "Is that what you're talking about?" So there was actual proof, and there was somebody on that plane coming here to go to the Jeep event this weekend.
Now, your play is going to be presented at Cooper's Lake Campground, where the Jeepers are gathering.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
And how many times will it be performed?
We're going to do two matinees on Saturday at 1 o'clock and at 3 o'clock, and then one matinee on Sunday at 2 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
We have a cast of people who are local actors, among them Jerry Johnston and Bob Meals, who, if your listeners are active in theater in Butler area, you would know who they are. And I've written an extra scene for the play that explains kind of the transition between the Army in the World War One and beyond era into the 30s, because when the Bantam Jeep was under construction, it was 1940 in October, so the United States wasn't officially in the war, and the United States Army had sent out to companies like the Bantam Jeep Company that were in the automotive business, like Ford and Willys and Chrysler,
mm-hmm.
Sort of a challenge to build an all-terrain vehicle that they said was as tough as a mule and agile as Fred Astaire. So it had to be something that, like the Timex watch, that could take a licking mm-hmm. and keep on ticking. So the guys at the Bantam decided to try it because the Bantam was company in Butler was going bankrupt. The Bantam car years were over, in a sense, and people were moving on to bigger automobiles. And if your folks don't know what the Bantam was, it was like the Austin British car. So it was sort of like a miniature version of a...
Very small.
Yeah,
vehicle.
Right. It was small yeah. only.
And it was manufactured here in Butler. In fact, the plant was only a few hundred yards from where we're sitting right now.
That's right.
It was down very close to what we now know as historic Pullman Park. So 1940.
Right, in October.
October, the Army put out a call for car companies to design this, and who knew that a tiny little car company in Butler, PA, would win the contest?
Yeah, it was really amazing because, well, they were in desperate straits. The company was going out of business, was going bankrupt, and this was sort of like the last chance to save it if they could come up with a design. And, of course, the design had to pass all the specifications from the United States Army, and also it had to outdo all these big companies like Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And the other aspect of it was it had to be done in 49 days. So as soon as they got this information, Roy Evans, who was one of the plant managers, went to his guys, and this was a regular assembly line kind of plant. We just have a few of the characters that would have been involved. Like I have a mechanic who represents the mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said to the guys, because basically it would save all their jobs if they could get this, let's come up with a design. And they designed, you know, the Bantam cars. So they had experience with that, just not with what the United States Army wanted. So they weren't able to come up with anything. And because they had that deadline of 49 days, they couldn't waste much time. So they contacted a car designer in Detroit whose name was Carl Probst and asked for his help. And he was designing cars for the big car companies. And, of course, he was a real hotshot at the time. He was a very popular car designer and wasn't going to leave Detroit and designing Cadillacs and Buicks to come down to Butler and try to design a Jeep. But they convinced him to do it. And he flew into the airport and out there in South Butler School mm-hmm. District area, right there off Route 8. Mm-hmm.
Penn Township,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and the mechanic picked him up there and brought him straight to the factory. And he started on the design. And basically overnight, they got a basic design because it had to include things that they already had, like the chassis for a Bantam and, you know, the running parts for a Bantam and so mm-hmm. on. And they managed to get it built under the 49 days. So they took off for Maryland, where the testing was going to be done on all the Jeeps that were entered.
So they drove the they built a prototype here in Butler, and then they took it to
They drove it right to Maryland, where it ran through all the tests that the Army wanted to have, and it passed all the tests. Wow, the guys who were representing Ford and Chrysler and Willys and all the others got to watch what was happening. So they, you know, kind of went to school on what the Bantam Jeep was doing and then transferred what they learned to their own companies, which made them have a real advantage over the Bantam Jeep company, who did everything on their own. And the United States Army had to admit that the Bantam Jeep was the best of the designs, but the Bantam Car Company was too small, they felt, to keep up with the demand that there was going to be for that vehicle.
So they needed tens of thousands
of
them.
The Bantam Car Company here just could not.
So who are the main characters in the play that you've written about this? Roy Evans, for sure.
Roy Evans is one of the main characters.
Carl Probst.
And then Carl Probst and the actor who represents the mechanics. There's, so there's one mechanic, and there's one person who's, this is a new scene written in, who was in the Army. And this was something that maybe people wouldn't even think about, because we can't imagine the Army without Jeeps and, you know, all-terrain vehicles, is that before the Jeep, the Bantam Jeep or any Jeep was created, all the pack-carrying, ammo-moving was done by mules. If you can imagine how antiquated that would be. You're out on the battlefield and you have a mule bringing your ammo to you or bringing your rations to you. And, of course, the mules, and just like the soldiers, are being shot and killed. So it's hard to believe that it could have been, the Army could have been, in a sense, that far behind.
And they were they also used mules to pull big artillery pieces.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
To pull them into place. And they were still doing that, weren't they, in the late 30s.
Yeah. So Hitler had what, and this is in the title of the play, what he called the Blitzkrieg, which was the lightning war. His tanks were moving across Europe, and in a sense, on the other side, here we have the United States Army moving with a mule train.
Yeah.
So it was just an incredible set of circumstances where something had to be done, and the word Jeep hadn't even been invented. It was just an all-terrain vehicle, and the Army said, here's the way we want it done, and it had to be something that you could repair right out on the field. You know, you had very few moving parts, and all were interchangeable. You know, if you had one Jeep, you could get a motor from another Jeep and put it in your Jeep and all that kinds of stuff. So it just had to be something that could adapt to almost anything. And the Jeep, even though it turned out that the Bantam Jeep didn't get the contract, the Jeep itself and the idea revolutionized war on the ground for the United States of America.
I've read there's a couple of different theories on how the name Jeep came about, but most people seem to think that it was because the Army referred to it as a general purpose vehicle, GP, general purpose, and most people think that that eventually evolved into the name Jeep.
That could very well be. And another one that I found in my research was that there was a cartoon character called the Jeep, J-E-E-P, and some people thought it might have come from that.
Well, that being the correct spelling,
yep,
maybe that has validity too. Who knows?
Yes, and I'm sure there are other, you know, if you had 50 people here that know history, there might be 50 different versions of where that came from. Just kind of like who shot Billy the Kid, or how many people Billy the Kid shot. Everybody has a different answer to that.
We're talking with Don Orwald. Don has written a play. Actually, you wrote this play a few years back, but you've expanded it for this particular production.
That's correct.
Right?
Yeah, and one of the things that I can't explain how it came to me, because I don't think it's true exactly, but just like who came up with the name of the Jeep, there are a lot of versions of that. But what is true is that when they had the design, when Carl Probst gave them the design and they built a prototype, it was over the weight limit that the United States Army had put. Like the thing had to do this and that and this and that and this and that, but it couldn't weigh over 1,200 pounds. And when they threw everything out that they could get rid of, you know, like being on the Titanic and throwing everything overboard, hoping it won't sink, it still weighed more than 1,200 pounds.
What did they do?
So they were ready to give up because there was nothing else left to throw overboard, you know. And so in my play, one of the guys said, so did you ever change a grade when you were in school? And everybody's going, what's that have to do with this? And they said, well, yeah, I used to change my E's to B's. And he said, well, we're going to change this number to a 3 instead of an 8. So it weighed 1,800 pounds. They put in 1,300 pounds, which was close to the 1,200 that was. And he said, what are they going to do? You know, and I doubt if they're going to weigh it. We say it weighs 1,300 pounds. We know it weighs 1,800. But they sent it in that way, and it did it. It passed the weight somehow. So they just lied. They just cheated because there was nothing else to do. And I think that tells you part of what American ingenuity is.
So what does your play cover? Where does it start?
It starts in October of 1940 and travels through to when the Jeep actually gets to the test site in Maryland. And there's a deadline when they have to be there. Mm-hmm. And in the way I've written the play, they get held up in towns that they're passing through by parades and people coming out wanting to see that new contraption and so on. So they actually get slowed down because of the interest in the Jeep and the fact that they have to that they're driving on roads and getting gasoline at gas stations and so on, and they had extra 5 gallons with them just in case. And so they just made it under the deadline. That part is true. I'll take the rest of it as a dramatic license. But they did make it, and not only did they come in under the wire, but they had what was considered to be the best design.
Do you concentrate a little bit on the work of Karl Probst when he was trying to, literally almost overnight, come up with a design for this vehicle?
Yeah, we have some artwork from a friend of somebody that a lot of people in Butler will know, Linda Harvey
Berkeley. Oh, yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
I asked her about what she thought we might do, and she had a friend who did some artwork for us. And one of the pieces that he did is based on Carl's actual first design for the Jeep. So you'll see like a blueprint, if you come to see the show, of what the Jeep started out to be. And then you'll see another drawing with the end product. So, but Carl literally did it overnight.
It's my understanding that the original prototype it was built here in Butler and then driven to whatever fort that was in Maryland for testing. The Army actually ran it into the ground. I mean, the testing was so severe, and it passed everything, and it was better than everybody else, but they just literally ran it until it fell apart. So somebody asked, well, you know, is it in a museum somewhere? The answer is no, it's in a million pieces somewhere. They built other ones here, but
yes,
that one that they took to for the Army testing doesn't exist anymore.
No, it does not. And I got to believe, okay, I mean, American soldiers were going to be depending on this vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
It deserved to be tested to the nth degree. And anyone would want that way. Well, and literally, as you say, that's what they did. I don't know that they were trying to somehow prove that it wasn't worthy of being picked. It obviously was. But I think they just felt they had to go on and on and see just when the camel breaks.
Push it to the limit, yeah. We'll take a quick break. A little bit more time to chat with Don Orwald. Nice to have him back here in his home area for just a few days. One of our sponsors on the program today is Miller's Shoes, 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler. I want to mention a couple of things for you. First of all, Miller's is your local headquarters for SAS Comfort Shoes. These are shoes that are made in the United States, by the way. Not too many shoes that are anymore. But these are America's favorite comfort shoes. And if you've never tried on a pair, they feel like bedroom slippers. They are really, really nice. SAS also makes comfort sandals, just as comfortable as SAS shoes. And they come in a variety of different styles and colors. They're beautiful. They're comfy. Why not stop into Miller's Shoes and ask Jimmy Chiprian, say you want to try on a pair of those SAS sandals for summertime. You'll love them. You'll love them. Also, athletic shoes for the whole family at Miller's. All your famous name brands. They've got them all there under one roof. Whether you like Nike or New Balance or Saucony or Rockport or Keds or Skechers or Easy Spirit or Asics or Pro Pet, they've got them all. Miller's Shoes. Always a great selection of shoes on sale, too, on racks for easy browsing. Stop in. Say hi to the Chiprians. Miller Shoes, 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler, now celebrating 126 years in business. Miller Shoes.
Put on your boogie shoes and get ready to dance the night away when the Platinum Band comes to the Tanglewood Entertainment Center on Saturday, June 15th. You'll relive some of the greatest hits from the 70s and 80s, but just when you think it's over, that's when the Motown and R&B kick in. Doors open at 6, buffet dinner by Chef George at 7, show starts at 8. Tickets are only $25, and as always, it's BYOB. It's the Platinum Band at the Tanglewood Entertainment Center, Saturday, June 15th. Call 724-287-0021 for tickets.
Thinking about remodeling or refinancing your home? ARMCO Credit Union's new HELOC combines the flexibility of a traditional home equity line of credit with the low fixed rate of a home equity loan. Lock in different amounts, rates, and terms up to 20 years under one convenient loan agreement and monthly payment without the hassle of reapplying as your borrowing needs change. It's never been easier to join, so call or visit us at one of our locations or online at armcocu.com to become a member. ARMCO Credit Union is an equal housing lender and is federally insured by NCUA.
Welcome back. My goodness, Don Orwald is here. Many of you will know Don from his years in the Butler area, the plays that he produced. In fact, before we went on the air, Don and I were reminiscing about some of the plays that we've done together with the Butler Little Theater and Musical Theater Guild. Don has retired from teaching, lives in Texas now. You live in the Fort Worth area?
Yes, it's a little town called Granbury, which is kind of like Saxonburg in that it has that town square and that little town feeling.
Don's been writing plays for many, many years, including down in Texas. And some years ago, he wrote a play about the development of the Jeep, and it's been expanded now with another scene added. And you have a chance to see it this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, at the Bantam Jeep Heritage Festival up at Cooper's Lake Campground in Slippery Rock, well, just outside of Slippery Rock. You say there are three characters, Roy Evans, Carl Probst, and then kind of an everyman mechanic,
right,
representing
and
the entire
squad. And we also
squad.
Then have the, like, the Mule Skinner, the fellow who talks about when the Army was still transporting everything with mules,
yes,
which was what just the opposite of what modern warfare called for. Mm-hmm. And then one character that is one of my favorite creations, who is not a real person, but it's a delivery girl from the Lindora Hotel. So it would, and when I'm, this character appeared the first time we did it. Of course, we were doing it right here in Butler. The kids that were in the show, a cast from New York came in as the, like, the world premiere of the show. When they got all these laughs every time they said Lindora, they didn't understand why, because they didn't know what the Lindora Hotel was or anything about Lindora. And, of course, if you know Lindora and you know the Bantam Jeep Car Company, it was just a couple of blocks apart. So I just decided to throw that in as a local reference, and it kind of got a few chuckles from the audience, especially people. Now, the Lindora Hotel is still open,
mm-hmm,
but people who remembered it from back in those days.
There is, I believe, just one building that remains from the old Bantam car plant here in Butler, and it wasn't part of the production line. It was the office portion of the Bantam plant It's a rather large building, two or three stories, pretty tall building. But that's all that remains of the carport.
I think that is of the original. Mm-hmm. When I was working my way through college, I worked at Armco in the summers. And sometimes we would get sent to what was called Plant 2.
Mm-hmm.
And that was basically where the Bantam car
yes,
plant was.
Yes, right next to the where the Bantam car plant was. And we're talking, actually started making cars late 20s or 30s, I believe. But as you said, they were very small cars. The original design came from England where they had small cars.
They got the okay to kind of use their designs. And so for a while they were calling them the Austin Bantam, mm-hmm. and then they become the Bantam Car Works. And Francis Fenn was the head guy at the Butler office, but Roy Evans was kind of the day-to-day guy working with the guys on the line, like the mechanics and so on. And Roy Evans, who was selling Bantam cars, was like the hot shot car salesman from like southern United States. He was one of those guys that could, you know, sell ice to Eskimos sort of thing.
Yeah.
So they hired him to come up to try to save the Bantam Car Works. And because I guess if you had a car that Roy Evans couldn't sell, it wasn't worth selling. Roy Evans was a real hot shot, but he was a lot of the impetus behind this, because he wanted to save the Bantam Car Works.
And as Don Orwald mentioned in the first part of our conversation, even though the Bantam Car Company won the competition, their prototype for what became known as the Jeep was the winner. It was just too small a company to even dream about producing the number of Jeeps that the Army wanted and needed. And so the big contract for building them went to Willys.
Yeah, it went to the car companies that could manufacture
they had
that
huge,
fast.
Huge
yeah.
production lines, yeah. multiple
and
plants and so,
so
on.
So the guys who worked to build the Bantam here in Butler were all local people.
Mm-hmm. I do understand that they got a contract to build the trailers for the Jeeps. Small trailers that they, well, like you'd hook onto a vehicle today, you know. In fact, some of the Jeep cutouts that you'll see on many buildings and places around Butler this
yes.
time of year, some of them have a trailer that they've added because they were built here in Butler.
Yeah, it's really neat if you've, like for me, I don't live in Butler anymore, but every time I come back, I do like to just drive around, see how many yards there are that have the sort of prototype of the old Jeep out there, just the way you would with the grandma watering the lawn, you know. It's just nice to see how many people got behind that, and of course, then we do have the reminders of Butler, the home of the Bantam Jeep, all around.
Well, once again, as our time runs out here, when will your play be performed? This weekend?
Yeah, we'll be doing two matinees on Saturday at 1 and at 3 and one on Sunday at 2. And when you buy your ticket to come to the event, there's no charge to come and see the play.
Mm-hmm.
That's just part of what you can do if you want to do it. And we're going to hope to perform outside. We've been rehearsing, and we are going to set up seating right there at the historic building. If you're not familiar with the area there, you can just ask anybody, tell me where the historic building is or where's the play going to be, and they'll send you off because that area is very, very big. And again, as part of the Don Orwald Arts Initiative, which we started almost 10 years ago,
yeah.
Some of the money from the overall event, not like maybe a tenth of your ticket or something, we're going to allow for donations so that we can continue to support our Mary Jo scholarship at the Butler County Community College. Mm-hmm. So if you, and we're getting ready to give our 10th scholarship. So it's proven to be something that has been workable, and people have been generous in donating. And so a kid with an interest in the arts and is going to the community college has a chance to apply for the scholarship. And you can get it twice. We've had a couple of people get the scholarship twice. always just great kids, and they always write a letter thanking us. And I know it's expensive to go to college, yeah. and we're only able to give about $500, but
it's a big help.
Been appreciative for yeah. it.
Don, it's good to see you again. Good I'm glad you were able to stop in the brief time that you're going to be back home.
Well, yeah. The plane didn't go down, you know. That was one of the things, especially we were on the ground for so long, I started to think something's really wrong with this plane. So that didn't happen. I came here early so Dave would know I made it.
That you were here.
Yeah, and everything has worked out fine.
We'll take a break. When we come back, our next guest will be joining us. We're going to be talking about some of the background of D-Day, the Normandy invasion. And we'll be speaking with Deborah Kruger, history professor at Butler County Community College. Back to talk to her right after these words, back in a couple of minutes. Time for a checkup for your pet. We recommend Suburban Animal Clinic. Or maybe Fido or Tabby's not feeling so well. Suburban Animal Clinic, a small animal veterinary practice located Route 8 south of Butler at the intersection with Thorncrest Drive. It's about 5 miles south of Butler. Suburban Animal Clinic, in the spirit of Dr. Dennis Damon. Their services include wellness checks for your pet, of course, also emergency care. They have laser therapy, dental available, also prescription diets. You know, one of the things that are problems for a lot of our pets these days, being overweight. Microchipping, they can handle that as well. Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8, south of Butler. If you're headed south from Butler toward Pittsburgh, as soon as you pass all the auto dealerships, start looking on your left. That's Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8 South at Thorncrest Drive.
You've lost a loved one. You feel alone. You think that no one really understands just how you feel, that it affects everything in your life every single day. Well, Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler offers a unique, sensitive program called Someone's Caring. It's carefully designed to help ease your pain and helps fill in the gaps when you feel so lonely. Men and women are invited to attend. Yes, more men are beginning to realize it's okay to express their feelings in a small group setting. They're finding it really helps. Over the last 20 years, we've developed a program that has helped so many people work through their grief. We offer 5 programs, a grief support group for those who have lost a loved one, for survivors of a suicide, for bereaved parents, and for those who have lost a pet, and individual sessions. Our own trained bereavement specialist, Robin S. Miller, personally conducts the sessions. Call us at Thompson Miller, 724-287-3706, 287-3706. We can help. Thompson Miller Funeral Home at the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, time-honored excellence.
Welcome back, good friends. It's the Friday edition of It's Your Turn, and I've been looking forward for some time to talk with our next guest. Deborah Kruger is here. She is a history professor at Butler County Community College. Deb, good to see you. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
We wanted to talk with her about the D-Day invasion of Normandy. Yesterday, of course, we marked the 75th anniversary. Tremendous coverage, and not only the national but the worldwide media. Would you agree? I'm sure you watched a lot of it on TV yesterday.
Yeah, I watched as much as I could. The coverage was beautifully done. There were a number of really moving ceremonies. It's such a significant battle. And so much of the world focuses on it, which is pretty amazing because there was so much else that was going on in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something that's memorialized and remembered in many ways as one of the key turning points in that huge war.
Well, I wanted to talk with you as a history professor, and you teach American history, among other things, right?
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. So obviously you teach this to your students at Butler County Community College. A little bit of the background, because D-Day so eclipses, you know, a lot of other stuff. It was 1944, mm-hmm. 75 years ago yesterday. World War II had been underway for 5 years already. It started in 1939.
Yes, it did. 39 with the invasion of Poland started the war for the European alliances. The United States did not want to get involved. We're back to wanting to remain isolationist.
Mm-hmm.
We had reluctantly gotten involved in World War I. 3 years after that had started in 1917. Americans were distressed, you could say. They felt that World War I had been caused by ammunition manufacturers and bankers and through loans that we had made to the Allies, and that that had pulled us into the war, and we had lost a lot of Americans in the war. It actually was extraordinarily bloody, the campaigns that the Americans were in, some of the bloodiest battles in our history as a nation. And so between that and then the Great Depression, Americans, our history has always had always been up to that point isolationist. We really didn't want to get back involved in a European war. And so in 39, when the war broke out with the invasion of Poland, and France and England had also tried to avoid war, same reason in many ways as America. We didn't. France and England did not want to get back into a war like World War I. World War I was so massive, so huge, so scarring, destroying really in many ways an entire generation. And you have to look at the time frame of it. We're talking 20 years from when the Treaty of Versailles was signed that ended World War I to when Poland is invaded. In those 20 years, you have the Great Depression. You have Hitler's rise to power, the rise of fascism with Mussolini in Italy. And Europe was watching this. These are men who had either fought in World War I or whose sons had died in World War I. And they don't want any reason that they could have not to go to war is what they're trying for. So we had appeasement, trying to stay out of it. After Hitler invaded Poland, they couldn't appease anymore. They couldn't give in anymore. And so war was declared. But fighting didn't start immediately. Hitler invaded Poland. He had made an agreement in August of 39 with Russia to actually divide Poland up.
Poland
was just decimated. And so the Polish Home Guard tried to fight off the Russians. They tried to fight off the Germans. And ultimately, within a month or so, they pretty much had lost. And they will be occupied by either the Russians or the Germans. I'm not sure whose side, you know, which do you pick? Which is worse? Mm. You know, they kind of were horrible to the Polish people either way. But the French and the British sat back and watched. Now, they declared war on Germany, but they kind of were biding their time. They wanted to see what Germany's next move was going to be. And Hitler capitalized on that. That gave him time to rebuild. And so they call it now the Sitzkrieg. They just kind of sat and watched. And then Hitler launched his kind of winter campaign into the spring of 1940, where he then showed the world, you could say, his true colors, and he moved forward to invade the Scandinavian region, the Netherlands, and then ultimately in the spring of 1940 into France, which of course fell rapidly and shockingly to the world.
So suddenly, between 1939 and really the middle of 1940, the Nazi troops, Hitler had taken Poland, Denmark, Norway, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Belgium, and France. They were all occupied countries.
And Spain stayed neutral, but in reality, many people knew Spain was in Hitler's pocket because he had helped get Franco into power with the Spanish Civil War in 36. And then, of course, Italy was allied, was part of the Axis powers under Mussolini. And gradually, many of the other countries in the Balkan region kind of fell in the line or at least went along with Hitler. Austria had been annexed by Hitler. Switzerland was kind of the sole remaining little enclave, and they didn't want people fleeing to their country. They would turn people back. So, yeah, Europe had become very, very much completely conquered in many ways. Russia was hoping that Hitler would abide by their agreement with them, and England basically stood alone.
So there we were, from just to set up a timeline, from 1940 to 1944, that's 4 years. And Hitler did not invade Britain. Now, they had what was called the Battle of Britain, massive bombing campaigns in London, but never any attempt to invade England.
He had intended to, at least that's what we believe, and he backed off. In fact, one of Churchill's most famous quotes is, "Never in the course of human history has so much been owed by so many to so few." And it was in reference to the RAF, which was the Royal Air Force, who during the Battle of Britain, which was in the August, September of 1940, the RAF had been able to hold off the Luftwaffe through tremendous sacrifice, they were helped with the advances of radar technology so that they could see where the Germans were coming. And because he lost enough planes, Hitler decided that it wasn't worth the invasion of England. He was just going to isolate them, leave them alone, kind of knock them out of the war that way, at least he hoped, and focus his attention somewhere else. He continued to harass England, though, with bombings. I mean, it was called the Blitz, and he continually bombed the English people throughout large portions of the next couple years with large casualties.
Meanwhile, the United States still not in it. And we wouldn't be, of course, until Pearl Harbor. But we kind of knew that we were probably going to get in it. I mean, there was... And I'm trying to remember back to my history courses, the Lend-Lease program, where the U.S. sent tons of war material to Great Britain, even though we weren't yet involved in the war.
Yeah, it was one of those tricky situations for Franklin Roosevelt. He understood that we would probably need to get into the war, yet the American... A lot of Americans, I'm not going to say all of them, but a lot of them still very much felt it's Europe's war. We don't want to get involved. And so he had to find a way to get around what were called the Neutrality Acts, which had been issued by Congress throughout the 1930s. And these were acts that were set up to keep us from getting pulled into another European war. So in World War I, we had gotten pulled in by submarine warfare, by lending a lot of money, by selling supplies to the Europeans. And so those Neutrality Acts actually said we couldn't do that, because we don't want to get pulled into another war. And so Roosevelt found a way to get around that with Lend-Lease. And he basically came up with the concept, look, if your neighbor's house is on fire, you're going to lend them equipment. You're just not going to expect to get it back. But in other words, Europe is on fire. We must lend them stuff. And so we would lend equipment to England. We also struck a couple deals. There was one called the Destroyers for Bases deal, where England loaned us, quote unquote, rented us some bases, naval bases, and in return we gave them some destroyers so that they could keep fighting that way. But this is really how we got the name the Arsenal of Democracy, because we had the industrial capability at that point in the late 1930s, 1940s to help supply Europe in a way that they couldn't sustain against this formidable fighting force that Germany was. And of course, once Russia was pulled in, Russia was attacked by the Nazis in June of 1941 in Operation Barbarossa, which is often considered to be Hitler's largest mistake, because at that point he then had to concentrate so much of his fighting force against the huge, vast expanse of Russia. He didn't learn from Napoleon's mistake. And once Russia was attacked, they were immediately brought into the circle of the alliances. And so we immediately then started loaning Russia, lending, leasing, however you want to call it, Russia materials as well.
So Hitler, and we're truncating here simply because we want to get to D-Day, but I wanted to get a little bit of the background. Yeah. So Hitler had to push a lot of his prime troops, his younger troops, his equipment to the Eastern Front, fighting Russia. And that meant that on the Western Front, France, and the English Channel, it became more of a defense rather than an offense. And Hitler brings in the Desert Fox to set up an Atlantic Wall, a defensive line along the coast of France. And that was Field Marshal Erwin Rommel. Hero of the Africa Corps earlier, and he comes in. He wasn't actually the supervising general, though, in France. Somebody named von Rundstedt or something like that. But Rommel was the guy who was given the task of setting up defenses, and boy, did he ever.
Yeah, there was over 2,400 miles of defenses on the Atlantic Wall. The intent of occupied France, when France was occupied, they occupied the northern western region. The southern region was known as Vichy France, which was a collaborative government. But those, the coast of France, Belgium, and up into the Netherlands was fortified with pillboxes, with concrete bunkers, with what we now call the hedgehogs, which were devices that were meant to, at certain points in the tidal cycle, to stop landing craft, to stop boats from getting in and ashore. And there were something like 4 to 5 million mines that were laid along the coast of France alone, over 6 million if you include the other coastlines. So yes, it was a defensive sector. Hitler just wanted to keep that side so that they couldn't attack along the western side. Mm-hmm. And he did have to divert his best troops to the Eastern Front for the Russian campaign. As Stalin liked to say, he was fighting Hitler the entire time while we were fighting elsewhere. But it was still an incredibly formidable defensive wall. And one of the reasons they waited till 44 to attack is they had to prepare, because if they failed, it was going to prolong the war, and it would be a psychological victory for Hitler and a defeat for us. And so they had to be absolutely prepared. That means some technologies had to be developed. And we had, in some ways, we tested and tried these amphibious assaults for the few years leading up to 44. We had Operation Torch with the landing in Africa. That was an early amphibious assault. Then you have the landings in Sicily and in Italy. Again, almost in some ways perfecting it, because the belief before World War II was that amphibious assaults were not good, that they couldn't work, particularly against the more advanced technologies of World War II. And one of the individuals with a deep belief in that, and almost in some ways a fear of amphibious assaults, was Winston Churchill. Because Winston Churchill had been the mastermind behind the Gallipoli campaign in the Dardanelles during World War I, which was an absolute disaster. Cost him his position in the government, and he wound up on the front lines of the French trenches in World War I, and had to then rebuild his career from that. So he was in many ways very, very hesitant to launch this amphibious assault. And in fact, at meetings between him and Roosevelt, and then eventually with Stalin, Stalin kept going, open a second front, open a second front, you know, you got to help me out here. And Churchill would be like, nope, not ready yet, not ready yet. So we did Africa first, then Italy. He wanted to go through the Mediterranean with that soft underbelly. And then finally, Stalin's like, you got to get in here. And FDR's like, yes, now's time. And Churchill reluctantly agreed that we were finally prepared in 44. But that was a big reason for why it took so long.
We'll take a break. We're getting the backstory to yesterday. You heard all the stories about D-Day. Today, the backstory. A quick break and then back with more here on It's Your Turn on WISR. One of our sponsors on the program today is Gone Postal Butler. You know, they package your items for shipping. Very convenient. Yeah. You just take your items to Gone Postal Butler. They package them up and you can ship them out to UPS, U.S. Postal Service, FedEx. That's your choice. They're located in the Shockey Mini Storage Complex, which is right behind King's and Villa Grande restaurants on Newcastle Road. By the way, they also offer a copying service, scanning, faxing. You can rent a temporary mailbox there. They even have an official notary. They're open Monday through Friday. It's your friendly neighborhood shipping center, Goin' Postal Butler. We'll be right back.
Butler Health System is a top 100 hospital for getting Doug back to playing with his grandkids and managing his farm.
For ensuring that Craig made it to his daughter's college graduation.
For helping Ray travel to Europe to visit his family.
At Butler Health System, we know what it takes to provide nationally recognized care. But more importantly, we know why we have to.
Caring hands, remarkable minds. That's Butler Health System.
Welcome back. We're talking with Deborah Kruger, history professor at Butler County Community College. The backstory to D-Day, which you heard all about yesterday. They even had Deb on the Turner Classic Movies last night. They replayed The Longest Day, the great Cornelius Ryan story with, it was made in the early 60s. Mm-hmm. Everybody who was anybody in Hollywood was in that film. I mean, it was literally a cast of thousands. But the backstory is interesting. In fact, I was reading, the Allies knew that they were basically going to invade France from somewhere. But Normandy wasn't actually the first pick. I guess they were looking at a place called Pas-de-Calais, which is much, much closer. England and France are much, much closer there. It's a very short distance across the channel.
Yeah, it's actually fascinating to talk about how they made the decisions and how they went about prepping for actually Normandy. Pas-de-Calais is the closest point between England and France. It's the shortest part of the channel. They did consider Pas-de-Calais, but I don't think they considered it for that long because Hitler expected the invasion there.
Uh-huh.
And so they actually played up on that. Interestingly, they asked English citizens to turn in postcards from visits to France. And they, you know, we take for granted satellite technology and, you know, Google Earth and things for planning invasions. They didn't have any of that. And so they took these postcards and they studied the beaches of France to try to figure out an alternative location for the invasion. And they had a couple criteria. They needed a place that had enough beach that they could land on, where the cliffs weren't too severe. They also needed a place that could have a port in a fairly close proximity, or where they could also build some mobile engineered ports, which we would eventually develop. And they wanted to use the element of surprise. There was enough worry about the Atlantic Wall. It was fortified by something like 50,000 German soldiers, and they understood the difficulties of this attack. And so Pas-de-Calais was the most heavily fortified region for Hitler. That was often where Rommel was housed. That's where they had the toughest divisions. And so they played up on that. It was actually known as Operation Fortitude. And it was the British intelligence services that in many ways set up the ability for victory with this. They did a number of things, including capturing German spies in England, because Hitler was sending spies over. And so when they would capture them, they would often turn them into double agents. So Hitler would not know they'd been captured, and they would have them funneling back information to Hitler that was wrong. And one of the pieces of information they would funnel back was that the attack was going to come at Pas-de-Calais. And they also created in that Operation Fortitude something known as FUSAG, which stood for First United States Army Group. And they created on paper an entire fake army. Hitler knew we were building an army in England. We were going to eventually have 3 million men and material. He saw this. He could see an invasion was coming. You know, they understood that. But on paper, they created this ghost army. They put Patton in charge. Patton, who had been kind of kicked out of Italy for other reasons, he was back in England. They had him strut around the streets of Kent and Dover so that spies would see him. And they actually had blow-up tanks, blow-up planes. They set up tents, and they made it look like right around the Dover-Kent area that there was this massive, massive buildup of military.
Which is quite close to Pas-de-Calais.
Right across from Pas-de-Calais.
Yeah.
And so Hitler believed that. In fact, he believed that. Now, he suspected Normandy as well. Normandy was where he suspected second. However, this espionage, this Operation Fortitude, was so successful that even after the attack began, even after we were already attacking the beaches of Normandy, Hitler was still nervous that it was only a diversionary attack, because this espionage had told him it's a diversionary attack. And so they waited. And they waited long enough that it allowed us to get on the beaches and get our toehold on the beaches rather than sending the reinforcements immediately. And so that was a very, very important piece of the puzzle that honestly we didn't know about probably not until the last 20 or 30 years, because it was classified for a very, very long period of time. So when they made the movie Longest Day, they didn't even know about these guys back in England who for months and months had been setting Hitler up for failure by convincing him that we were definitely coming to Pas-de-Calais and not to Normandy.
There was a part played by the French Resistance as well. I can imagine France had been occupied for 4 years, almost 5 years. Imagine that, your country being occupied.
Mm-hmm.
No wonder the French were so grateful to America for liberating them. You can imagine if we were occupied for 5 years and another country hopped to liberate us. But the French Resistance, you know, they would blow up rail lines and blow up telephone poles and stuff like that. They had to get secret word, code words, that the invasion was coming, and there was some great concern. I was reading about this. It might even be in Cornelius Ryan's book about the Longest Day. It wasn't in the movie, where the code word for the overlord was the Normandy invasion. It turned up in a crossword puzzle in England right before the invasion, and the Eisenhower and the Allied commanders went berserk because they thought somebody had broken the code. Because overlord, what a strange word. How could that ever be in a crossword puzzle, for goodness sakes? It turned out to be just one of those accidents, you know. It was no big deal.
Secrecy was absolutely key, and trying to keep this secret for the months and months. I mean, they were planning for a very, very long period of time. Eisenhower got over to England in January of 44, once he was picked to be the Supreme Allied Commander of this invasion. They had talked about using Marshall, George Marshall, who was from Western PA, mm-hmm. Franklin Roosevelt didn't want to have him leave the U.S. He was too key for that. So they had Eisenhower do this, who had also been in charge of the African, had been involved in the African invasion. And it just took took all of the spring of 44 to plan this. And one of the reasons Eisenhower was picked, because he was so good logistically. He was just very, very good at that detail-oriented type organization. But the fear was, you know, loose lips sink ships, that this was going to get out. They actually quarantined the paratroopers for over a week before they went out. They had 3 days picked, the 5th, the 6th, and the 7th as possible dates for launching the attack. They had to do it during a fairly full moon so that they could have visibility. The tides had to be at a certain level. It couldn't be very choppy or the landing craft could get swamped. And it just had to have all of these variables. And there was only some windows of opportunities. One was that first week of June. The next wasn't going to be till almost the third week of June. And they were super, super worried that if they didn't launch it quickly enough, that the secrecy would be broken. All of those efforts to keep Hitler in the dark, or at least confused, would fail. And then if Hitler had been there at, you know, another thing that happened was the weather was so bad, predicted to be so bad, that Erwin Rommel, the Desert Fox, who was in charge of this, actually went home to Germany for his wife's 50th birthday, because the Germans did not think anybody would invade in that possible weather. Yeah. And so he wasn't even there. And so when the attack happened, that delayed reinforcements from going. It also was delayed because they had to go through Hitler to launch reinforcements. And Hitler slept till 10 a.m. And they started the invasion at 6:30 a.m. Nobody was willing to wake Hitler up. I don't know about you. I don't think I'd be willing to wake Hitler up. Wow. And then he delayed it even further, because he was convinced it was a diversionary attack. And so it took well over half a day before they even began to move reinforcements to the beaches, which again gave us a chance to get the toehold there. And as much as we've heard about how vicious and how difficult the fighting was, I can't even imagine what it would have been like had they had the full forces there, had they gotten back up there immediately and not delayed their actions. It could have been a very different outcome.
The final break, we'll be back to wrap up our conversation with Deborah Kruger right after these words.
Do you have missing teeth or wear dentures? You may have heard of or are considering dental implants. Hi, this is Dr. Bob Todd of Butler Smiles Dental Care. There are many options available with dental implants, and making the right choice can be confusing. I have been placing dental implants since 2004, both full-size traditional implants and small diameter or mini dental implants. There are indications for both, but more and more we are using mini dental implants in a variety of innovative ways. They are easier to place, causing less discomfort, are less costly, and can frequently be used immediately after placement, allowing you to get back to eating the foods you like or smiling again right away. Traditional implants typically have a 4-month healing time before they can be used. I invite you to call our office at 282-7774 to schedule a free consultation to see if mini dental implants are the right solution for your dental problems, or visit us on the web at butlersmiles.com.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. Wrapping up our conversation with Butler County Community College history professor Deborah Kruger. One other thing that, you know, there's so much talk about D-Day. We certainly saw it all day yesterday. D-Day was no sure thing. It was no definite guarantee. In fact, Eisenhower was so worried that he actually wrote a letter in advance saying that if this failed, it was all my fault.
Yeah, he had a very difficult position to be in. He had to make the call to go. And there was no guarantee that the weather was going to be okay. In fact, it was supposed to happen on the 5th of June. They were all set to go. They had even, I think they'd given ice cream to the airborne divisions who were going to head out just after midnight. And then right at the last minute, they called it back because the weather was too severe, particularly the waves, the choppy waves and things in the channel. And then he heard through their weather forecasters that there was going to be a break. And so he decided to go on the 6th. Again, it was uncertain. There were a lot of people who thought he was crazy. There wasn't going to be enough of a break for them to make it work. And he felt that they had to do it at that moment and take that gamble. And so he was very, very worried. Yeah, it was a massive relief, I'm sure, for himself when they actually succeeded.
And one other final note, even though they got a toehold on D-Day and a couple of days thereafter, it was no easy breakout of Normandy. It took quite a while for the Allies, the Americans, the British, and the Canadians to break out of Normandy and start to make their way toward Paris.
Yeah, it was very difficult fighting. They hadn't expected it to be that bad. Their surveillance had told them beforehand that it would be fighting through fields, through French farm fields, with these hedges between the fields. And they didn't realize that these hedgerows were centuries old, were enormous, and the Germans could hide entire tanks in them, and you wouldn't know they were there. And so they had to fight basically field to field with an enemy that was entrenched, was dug in. And so the Germans were willing to fight. They had some very, they had brought over some tough forces, including some Hitler youth, people who had been brought up, really indoctrinated by Hitler. There were some SS divisions who will fight there. And so the fighting was very, very fierce throughout Normandy. It took them a lot longer than expected and more casualties. In fact, a number of the campaigns within the Battle of Normandy, actually had greater casualty rates than the Battle of the Somme in World War I, which most people don't realize. And we weren't able to liberate Paris until August 25th, 1944. Didn't get into Germany until October